Good day, everyone, and welcome to the second workshop regarding request for applications process for 2020 and 2021 conference call hosted by Marissa Button. My name is Leslie and I'm the event manager. During the presentation, your lines will remain on listen only, and if you require assistance at any time, please key star zero on your telephone and a coordinator will be happy to assist you. I'd like to advise all parties that the conference is being recorded for replay purposes. And now I'd like to hand you over to your host for today, Marissa. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. Welcome, everyone. We are so happy to have you here today with us for the second workshop for our upcoming RFA cycle for 2020-2021. My name is Marissa Button. I'm the Director of Multifamily Programs. And hopefully you've been able to have a copy of the agenda. If you're joining us on the phone line, it is on our website on the competitive page. And if you're here in the room, there are extra agendas in the back. And if you are here with us today, please make sure as a guest that you sign in the back before you leave if you haven't done so already. So we're going to go through the different components of the agenda like we handle our workshops usually and stop periodically for comments or questions and feedback, and we will kick off with doing some introductions of the folks with us here on the panel today, and we'll start out with Trey, our Executive Director.
Good afternoon, everybody. Trey Price, Executive Director here at Florida Housing. I'm excited that there are so many folks here. I guess everybody's in town for, obviously, tomorrow's board meeting. Exciting to have everybody here. Look forward to your feedback and with all stakeholders available, so that's great. Thank you.
Kevin Tatro, Director of Development Finance.
I'm Laura Cox, Director of Asset Management.
Good afternoon. Bill Aldinger, Director of Policy and Special Programs.
Jean Salmonson, I'm one of the Assistant Directors in the Multifamily Programs Department.
I'm Dietra Arnold. I'm the Business Analyst for Multifamily Programs.
Thanks, everyone. And we have a ton of staff in the room as well, so this is always a really nice opportunity to make some FaceTime with folks that you're usually communicating with over email. So we're excited, again, to have everybody here today. So this is the second workshop, and as the agenda says, intended to provide information on anticipated changes to the upcoming RFA cycle. So we find ourselves in a really unique situation here where we're talking about the upcoming RFA cycle, and I hope we're not going to have an echo. Just going to calm down a little bit. Move over here. But anyway, we're in a unique position because we are in active litigation on some cases for RFAs that have come through the last cycle. And we have RFAs that we're taking to the board to recommend for funding. And so I will make the disclaimer I usually make when we're in these circumstances. We're talking about future funding, and so information here is not intended to be used as the corporation's position in any other context. And so we appreciate being able to keep the ball rolling as we are transparent and want feedback for cycle as we go through that process. So, again, please be respectful of that as well as we go through the items that we have here. So the other big picture item that I want to address that you can see in the agenda in different portions, but there is a theme overall that we're trying to achieve. And in years past, we've always had this on the agenda, and some of you in the room have come up and commented on it, that we're always looking for ways to better identify the best developments that we can fund in an effective way within the constructs of what we want to see develop for the residents of Florida. And so with that in mind, we have some recommendations of things that we want to see changed in the RFA cycle. And it really comes down to three big philosophical things we're taking a really hard look at. The first is regarding due diligence on the front end for the RFAs. So you'll see we're looking for feedback on maybe going to a point system for ability to proceed items. We think it's important to consider that because the more ability to proceed we have on the front end, hopefully the less delay we're looking at in the back end. And we know that delay is going to happen and every deal is different and there's circumstances that come up. But philosophically, we are looking at that and we think it would be important and beneficial really for the funding to go to developments that have an ability to proceed off the jump. So that's one pillar of what we're going to be talking about. Another pillar of what we're going to be talking about is a concept here that is a look back of accountability with regard to funding on the front end. If there's developments that have had to have numerous extensions, either through credit swaps or through requests for extensions that have to go to the board, that there is some accountability in that in terms of being eligible to achieve points if you're in that circumstance. And, of course, we think that makes sense because you got to focus on what you've got going on in the pipeline. You know, maybe we need to focus our funding on those that don't have those issues. Again, we get that there's going to be issues, but we're trying to wrap our arms around it in a different way. So we think that makes sense. And then we have some pretty robust changes that we're talking about for proximity. Again, it's looking at, as you've hopefully been able to review the agenda, and we talked about at the first workshop, some items that had been taken off the shelf for a while for community services, and a different way of looking at point values and a different way of looking at how we've done historically the proximity funding preference. Again, this is with the, and I'm sure everybody will have something to say about it, and but this is a little bit different than it's been done in the past. Been different than we're doing it now, and again, it's to look at, you know, really getting a pool of applications that provides what we're looking for in a predictable way and doesn't incentivize flooding the field of applications in order to achieve a beneficial lottery number. So it's not all about lottery. It really is about getting what we're looking for and really honing in on that. So I'll stop, like, lecturing now, but I wanted you guys to have that in the background as sort of philosophically what we're looking at when we talk about some of these things. And then there's just some one-offs in here that, you know, we'll talk about. So the first big item, we've talked about the timeline. So where we're at with the timeline, we're going to hopefully be presenting the final timeline to the board at the July board meeting. So we're waiting to hopefully see what kind of awesome appropriation we get for the sale program and get all of those things teed up, and we'll anticipate having one more of these workshops as we hone in on what we're really settling in on for the items we're moving forward within the cycle, and then the timeline will be presented to the board over the summer. So we do anticipate having at least one more overall workshop. The potential changes and clarifications to all that would apply to basically all RFAs. So the first two items, A and B. We talked about bringing back the environmental form as just a straight requirement. And we know that there can be challenges associated with that because we formerly had that as a part of the process. So let me also say, you know, there's a lot of history in the room and there's a lot of history in Florida Housing staff. So we're not pretending like we don't know things that were tried before and didn't work. We're looking at things in a different way as well. So we talked about requiring it to be provided, but then we have a discussion point below that we'll be looking for feedback from, which is maybe this should be a point item. And into Section B about ability to proceed forms, maybe we should identify point values associated with those as well. So if you can't get your environmental form, but you own your piece of property, or you've got a long-term lease with a local government, and you're not simply relying on an eligible contract, you could get more points for that. So that's what we're looking at in terms of those items, and that's what we really want some feedback from you all about. And what would make sense should we identify those, what would make sense in terms of what we would identify to have effective point values for that purpose. And again, you know, like we mentioned, possibly site plan approval. If you're ready to go and you have site plan approval, like it makes sense if you meet all the other requirements that we have, that you get, you know, a better look in terms of the ranking and selection for funding, we think. And that's cutting off some of the issues that we deal with in the back end, ideally. So, again, keep that in mind, and we'll go on through some of the other items here and then open up the line for comments and questions. Part C here, we are not expecting any changes to the CNA process. We will be providing some clarifying language in Exhibit F of the RFAs, which go through the CNA process. So if you don't do rehab, this probably doesn't mean much to you, but if you do, you know, we're coming off of the past 2 years of having the CNA process implemented. We're doing analysis on what we're seeing from that. One thing we are seeing outright is that we're still getting applications in for substantial rehabilitation, and we're getting preservation applications in. And so we are going to continue the process and continue to refine how we implement it. Is there anything you wanted to add on that, Bill, from a policy perspective? Okay. So stay tuned, and that's really just to, you know, if that's the type of the developments that you're proceeding with. We hope to have our LDAs posted to the website in May, and most of you should already know that the geographic areas of opportunity are currently posted to our website, and that is important because, as we'll talk later in the agenda, we have goals through some of those, so you have an idea of what you're expecting. We have, you know, we did consider the feedback about maybe looking at prior years of designated geographic areas of opportunity and whether we would consider if they've fallen off for the census tract for this year, whether we keep them on, and we are not inclined to consider that. You know, if the goal is that they're meeting those targets in the census tracts, we're going to have fidelity to what those current census tracts tell us in terms of that information. So those are on the website. And then some TDC per unit changes. I'm going to turn it over to Kevin to talk a little bit about that, what we have teed up for that.
All right. Thanks, Marissa. I think I presented the last workshop on RFA processes that we had a stakeholder developer who provided comments last summer about changing the TDC per unit limitation process for developments that are involved PAC rehab. Right now, the acquisition costs are part of that cost limitation, and acquisition costs are actually limited by an appraisal. So we have a cost limit and an appraisal covering that. And for those properties that actually have a high acquisition price per unit, it limits how much rehab you can do the property. So the idea here is to provide a limit that is just related to the new rehab costs going into the project and letting the appraisal handle the land and appraise values as a limiting factor. And so I looked at, and there's a white paper on the website, like 2.5 pages long. I looked at 31 different underwriting reports that had to do with PAC rehab in the last 18 months. They were in South Florida and they were like the rest of the state. And the idea was for me to look at the range of building costs relative to the limits, and then try and figure out a way to reduce the current limits that still leave you with a sufficient amount of rehab costs out there to get the project done. And so I went ahead and did that, and there's a discussion on the website, goes through the process, and the box at the very last page, it basically says that for garden rehab deals, I would take the limit and reduce it by 32.5%, and the rest would be used for your actual limit, your limits for rehab. On non-garden rehabs, it would be 27.5% reduction. And given that the non-South Florida limits for gardens would leave you $120,000 plus as a rehab cost limit, and on non-garden it'd be $181,000 plus. And looking at the 31 samples that I went through, all of them would have met those limits without a problem. So I don't think there were any issues with that new process. There was one development that was non-competitive that didn't have a limit, but if I had a limit on at the time, it would not have met the limit going into the deal, but would meet the limit on the new process. So it kind of frees up, I think, some of the issues that are presented in the current process. So starting next cycle, you'll have a lower limit listed for ACT rehab deals as a cost limit, but it's just the new cost expenditures for that limit. And since those are new expenditures and not contracted expenditures, I don't need to have a separate escalation rate for ACT rehab deals. Like right now I have like a 3% for new construction and 2.3% for ACT rehab deals. Because that 2.3 takes in the fact that you have fixed costs and acquisition as part of that number. But now it could be 3% across the board or whatever the new number is when we get to setting out new TDCs for next year. And then the other thing I want to bring up on the agenda here is I think there's been enough information that it appears that Palm Beach County should probably get the same South Florida higher cost limit that Broward and Miami-Dade get. So next RFA cycle, the South Florida TDC boost for TDC limits would also include Palm Beach County.
Thanks, Kevin. And if anybody can't hear in the back or is having difficulty, we have plenty of seats in the front if you'd like to make your way up here. Just wanted to let folks know if you couldn't see, there are extra seats up here. But we will try to be loud and raise your hand if you can't hear us. Getting an okay sign. All right. So we'll do this next one is brief, and it's about the advanced review process. And, I hope this shouldn't be too much of a surprise. Advanced review, we process, and it takes, it's time-consuming. LISTLRP does an amazing job administering that process, but we are at a point with the capacity of, you know, what we have coming in, that we need to have a point by which we're not taking those submissions. And we know that we don't provide a guarantee. The terms of the RFA generally say usually that we have 2 weeks to consider advanced review forms as they come in, but we get a lot of desperate requests at the last minute, and it's problematic, and it kind of goes against the whole point of advance review, right? So we're going to just change the language to reflect what we have here. If you're not going to get the 5 points if your date approved is not in that two-week period of the application deadline, if it's approved within the 2 weeks before the application deadline. So, and if we get to a point where we can move back again at some point, that may be, but we want to just put some boundaries around that. We think it makes sense for us and for Liz. It's a lot of work. So I think this is a lot of big picture stuff that we talked about. And before we jump into the big items on the next page, we will be happy to take some comments or questions at this point about anything that's come up so far. And, yes.
Yeah, can I take one point?
Yes.
So on the advanced review process, it's going to be based on the date we last received the request to review it, not the date we approve it, send it back to you. So there's no, like, Florida Housing, you're holding us up here kind of issue. It's just you get it in, and then we have 2 weeks, send it back to you.
Yeah. Thank you. Sorry. And comments.
Thanks. Steve Auger with Birdsong Housing. Really appreciate you guys holding the workshop and giving us the opportunity to comment and think through this. And really just had a question. As we get into some of the other stuff on the agenda, are you thinking that you're coming up with point items in a system where, you know, where things continue to funnel towards there's a match score that everybody gets and it all kicks the lottery? Or are you thinking that you're coming up with a system where there are so many points that no one gets match points and those points are delineated?
I think it's the latter. I think that's the, as we've been discussing it, and we're still working through it. So we would take feedback about what you all think is the right thing. I mean, we know what we've seen where it's the threshold. If we say it's a max amount, folks are going to meet the max amount. The question is, do we have the type of the way we assign the point values? Is that going to be a lower number inherently of applications that could meet all of those? So I think we're still working through it, and feedback to us on that would be important.
And I appreciate that, you know, because that kind of thing makes the answer, you know, to the question of should this be an eligibility requirement or a point item.
Mm-hmm.
If you're still heading towards the funnel process, it doesn't matter. They're all the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you've got enough meaningful stuff to score on, you know, which is always sort of the trick, if you're coming up with a lot of points. And I think there's lots of, and I'm sure you're going to hear more about it today. I don't want to steal anybody's thunder, but there's a lot of ideas about readiness to proceed and how to either hold folks accountable, you know, or you know, include items that could score. I thought the environmental review form was a good place to start because it's meaningful, it's not high cost, and it wasn't an area where people made a lot of mistakes, right? You know, as you all know, that's part of the problem. The more things we include, the more things you make mistakes on, and you know, theoretically, in the RFA process, you've got the ability to waive minor irregularities, but But if you're going back to where that's a much more meaningful delineator, of course, then that'll get the different level of legal scrutiny that you've had thus far.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the last just big picture things that we can be thinking about as we're making comments, it appears in here, you know, that your intention is to continue to pursue the priority one, priority two, you know, application limit. And that makes a difference on sort of the scoring mechanisms. And just, you know, can you give us some feedback about what your intentions are on that or where you guys are with making that decision? Because that impacts, you know, just a lot of things about the scoring paradigm that you're coming up with.
Sure. And I'll address that right now. On the application or the agenda, we do have included maintaining priority one, priority two designation in Miami-Dade and adding it in small medium. And so the way we're looking at this right now is, you know, the intent and, you know, when we originally workshopped this concept of priority one, priority two for Miami-Dade was that we're honing in on developers identifying to us the three best applications, you know, that they have because we could fund a max of three and we went through all that analysis of the intent of that process. And much the same way, I think a lot of it depends. If we are able to effectively focus on ability to proceed and reconcile on the back end accountability for what happens in underwriting, inherently, I imagine we're going to get to a point where we might not need to have priority one, priority two. But ultimately, we're not going to abandon that concept right now because I don't think we're there. So folks need to understand that we're not willing to abandon that process right now. And at the same time, we know that we have to really dig in on how we address what it means to be priority one, priority two. And, you know, we put language out and we always hope we get it right. And when we don't get it right or it ends up different than how we anticipate, we look to you all as a stakeholder community for us to help us hone in on how we effectuate what we're trying to get across. So I think the answer, we're not going to abandon that process for this scoring mechanism, but I think we have to keep considering both. Because let's be honest, if in the next part we talk about looking at having accountability for, I hate to say behavior because it sounds very, punitive, but I guess it kind of is depending on what we settle on, we still have to designate the entities and the, associated principals, you know, affiliates or financial beneficiaries that conduct relates back to. So we still have to keep having this conversation and need feedback for how we address those things. And we've had some public comment already in advance of the workshop where folks have given us some feedback for some language to look at, looking at how other states do their processes as well. So we're willing to take feedback on that. Oh.
So just to be clear, you're sort of looking for feedback on this way and that way.
All of it.
While you guys are trying to figure out which way you're going.
Yes.
Hi, Sean Wilson, Blue Sky Community. Number one, thank you for responding to prior input about how to find ways to distinguish the best developments from each other. I think that there's not 191 equal median county sites in the state of Florida, and so definitely I applaud your efforts there. I think that going to a point system and also some of the other hard to achieve tiebreaker things that I guess you'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. Also get to that, so I think you're going in the right direction. I was one of the ones who said maybe you should include last year's GAOs in this year's cycle, but since it's already up and it was only February, I appreciate you getting that up right away. That's good. On the additional developer experience points discussion, I'm going to repeat a comment that I may have made in public. I think I made it to a couple of y'all face-to-face. I don't like this methodology here, because it, first of all, this doesn't say how far back are you going to look. I mean, it's not clear. So I'd like to see something along the lines of you are just not eligible to apply if you have X number of developments in credit underwriting. Mm-hmm. If you've got stuff hanging on that you got two deals funded last year and five deals funded the prior year and all seven of them are hanging out there in credit underwriting, yes, don't apply for more funding. I mean, I'd like it to see it handled in that kind of a way. But I do think that there should be some delineation in that regard as far as prior performance vis-a-vis timing.
Thank you, Sean. And you did jump ahead. So if I had introed that, I would have said we may put time frames on this to implement it and things like that. But no, I'm kind of joking with you there. But we hear what you're saying, definitely. Any other comments from the floor? Leslie, could you please open up the phone line if there's anybody in the queue with comments or questions?
Yes, of course. Thank you, everyone. If you want to ask a question, it is just star, then one on your telephone. If you want to withdraw the question, it's star two, and that's star, then one on your telephone to ask a question. And we have no questions.
Okay, so page two. Jane, come on up.
Hi, Jane, it's my time. We've had a couple conversations between the review committee people, and one of the...
Could you identify with TAG or with...
With the review committee, not review committee, RFA committee with CAP.
Thank you.
Okay. Sorry. One of the things that we've discussed is the possibility of having a pre-app. Now, I know in the past, Florida Housing hasn't wanted to do a pre-app because it opens up a lot of issues with them, but one of the ideas that we came up with was having a pre-app that is self-scored. So the pre-app, people put in their applications, see how they would score in the upcoming cycle. They're out there for about 30 days. People can go in and look and compare their app to other apps to see how they would score and whether they want to go forward with the full application. A little bit different than the way other states do it, but
mm-hmm.
We can, you know, just throwing that out for.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Jane, and when would the lottery number be
On full application.
And so the question that came from the audience was when would the, in that type of concept, when would the lottery number be assigned? And your suggestion is at formal application,
right.
Not pre-application.
Yeah, we're figuring that if you're making changes, that it may not come down to lottery number, but if it does, then it would be done at full application.
So because I can see there being, you know, in an RFA that is funding selection heavily relies on lottery, you know, there's that might not work very well, right? But if
right.
So what you're saying is if we implemented some of these changes that we think would have the inherent effect of maybe not getting to lottery, then you're going to see, you know, what other folks' proximity scores are and things like that. And so that's interesting for us to consider. I think when we've thought about the concept of pre-app previously, it has been, we've perceived it as challenging because of falling under Chapter 120 and whether we say we're scoring that pre-app, but what you're saying is that you all would, you know, you all would just look at what another has and then make that determination.
Correct.
Interesting.
And this is just like the first iteration of the idea. So if it was something that had to come to lottery, then we would figure out whether the lottery numbers were going to be assigned at the beginning or on the second.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks for the feedback.
Good afternoon, Ken Taylor from Atlantic Pacific. First of all, I think the ability to proceed focus is a great idea in general with depth and details, but I think you're headed in a good direction. One question I have is the language that you're proposing to strike on the zoning form. I couldn't tell what the purpose of striking that was. So.
Thanks. Let me go back to that. You know, we've had issues with that that terminology, and so our legal folks looked at it, frankly, and said, well, what is really the need for this? We get questions from local governments about it, and we don't want them to have to be questioning us on what they're signing, and so it's really sort of, again, last year we'd made some changes to try to get rid of these things that become an issue that shouldn't be. You know, they're committing to the zoning that's appropriate for the proposed development with the amount of units and all of that good stuff. And so we felt like we could remove that.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks. Okay. Seeing no one else approach the microphone, on page two, and we are going to, I'm just saying this, I know I'm going to be talking fast and going through things, so please jump up if, at the appropriate time. We have questions and comments, but we are wanting to get through this by 4 o'clock, needing to, we must actually, so just keep that in mind. But it's been really good back and forth so far, so please don't let that deter you either. So the developer experience points to Sean's point that he just made. This is sort of a general concept of what we came up with. So the idea is that 15 points, wherever that point value may be, if you've not been granted more than one, so, you know, we're starting at that very base level. Like, you know, we understand there may be one-off issues, and so you get a pass on that. Exchange of housing credits, so, you know, a credit swap, or more than one second extension of a corporation-designated deadline for any development and underwriting. So you're coming and you're asking for a second extension of your firm loan commitment or something like that. Then you just wouldn't be eligible for that point value in the RFA. It's an interesting idea. You know, yours is a bit different because what Sean mentioned was more of a, well, if you're just in underwriting anyway, you should be focusing on that. I think one thing we do recognize, though, is there are different inherent levels of capacity with folks, and so we chose to look at this in a way of, well, if you can't do what you told us you were going to be able to do originally when you came in for funding on more than one development, that's when we want to take the look. And so we talked about, you know, there would have to be a look back period, right? Is it 18 months? Is it 12 months? Is this something that we could even put in place and as a warning now that as you're getting funded for what's going forward, you're not going to, this is going to apply, kind of like we did with the local government area of opportunity funding preference. We said, hey, know that if you get this year, next year you're going to have a problem or the applicant would draw disincentive. Some of that stuff we gave the warning on the cycle that we implemented and then actually acted on it so there wasn't retroactivity. So we're willing to have those conversations and see where we can land on that, but I think it's it is something that's important to us, and it's important that you know the development that you're experiencing things that cause delay and that are legitimate, but we also see where developments come in and they've got less ability to proceed on the front end and it's just taking longer, so we're trying to hit the sweet spot with that. We also, moving on to subpart I there, this came up in, hopefully those of you who are here also joined us for our rural development workshop on Monday. We talked about this, there. We're just putting in, information in the, applicant, authorized principal representative, certification form. That you acknowledge that we may request additional clarifying documentation, including the independent CPA audit documentation for housing credits from the review of the development and construction costs in order to timely review the cost certification documentation. We were coming off of a year of going through an audit, and in that process, in doing lookbacks, it was difficult to obtain information, and so we want to make it really clear in the front end that the professionals you're working with know that there's an expectation that we may be asking for additional information. So that's really what that is there to reference. And then, you know, big, small statement here in J, but very big sort of discussion, and so I'll start out by saying we will put out and publish an actual thought about our recommendation in writing so you can look at this. But we've been generating ideas about how we handle credit exchanges and the increased amount of requests for those that we have seen that have not really stopped since the equity market issues that perpetuated a lot of those requests legitimately coming in, of course. The tide hasn't been stemmed with that over time and even as the market has settled. And we know our sister HFAs in other states are dealing with much of the same thing as well, an increase in requests for exchanges, and are also looking at more ability to proceed on the front end, and some of you here develop in those other states as well, too, and know that. And so we engaged with CAP. CAP created a subcommittee on underwriting, and they brought some recommendations to our attention on various underwriting issues that we were looking at. And through that, we also decided to look at the credit swap situation. And then through that, and I give a lot of credit to Melissa Levy and her staff, engaging with syndicators on, you know, we know that in many ways you're just the messenger asking for the swap. The demand is coming from your investors and the syndicators, and so then you're left coming to us saying we need it, or, you know, they're going to depart. And so how can we really get to a system that works well for you all, for them as partners in the process as well too, and that that everything's moving forward? So if you followed the rule development workshop, hopefully you did, and go back and please look at the agenda there if you haven't. In our QAP, we've recommended some changes that essentially allow for an administrative automatic request and for a credit exchange beginning in the third quarter. So after the second quarter of the year of the year placed in service, if you are 50% complete for construction, documented by one of the four required site inspections ordered by the credit underwriter. So if you are 50% or more complete, the corporation will give that administrative credit exchange. And the theory is you're moving, you're going, you're there. It's great. We're with you on the process. And then, the exchange would need board approval if you make it prior to the third quarter of that placed in service year. And we understand that may be necessary for developments that are not able to meet their 10% test, or if you do not reach 50% completion by that point in time after the second quarter, so when you're in the third or fourth quarter of the placed in service year. So that was what we talked about at the rule development workshop that impacts this. But we have some additional items that we're considering that aren't particularly rule development, but in terms of fees, because one of the things that we talked about with the CAP underwriting committee was, well, maybe we'll just have you all have to pay a second administrative fee for a swap, and that'll make you really want. And we got, you know, legitimate concern about that, because that number isn't a hard and fast number either, and could be problematic. And so, and some of you who don't know this because you've never asked for a credit exchange, the fee is the $15,000. That's the fee that's in place now. That's incorporated through our RFAs. So what we're talking about is changing the fee to $10,000 if it's requested in the third quarter. And the thought process is we want you to be communicating with us and get those requests in early, so we are not dealing with a deluge at the end of the year and processing that. So it's good for communication purposes. It's good for processing purposes. And then it would be a $20,000 fee if it's requested in the fourth quarter. And then on the back end, prior to issuance of 8609s, we would charge a $5,000 fee per month beyond the original placed in service date. You know what your original placed in service date, and then each month thereafter that you are lingering on is a fee that's attached to that. Okay, so again, this is a lot of numbers to take in, and we'll put this online, but we wanted you to understand what we were thinking about when we were honing in on this. And then, of course, the other consequences, what we talked about earlier with the point system, you're going to have an impact if you have more than one of these type of exchanges as well. And then for the issue of second credit swap request, again, it's still going to have to be, we really do not want to keep doing these. So everything that we're trying to work towards is not having to get to that process. Basically, we would charge the, if it was substantiated that there was the hardship, and, you know, of course the board would have to approve this, you would be charged the $10,000 credit swap fee, and then you would have to pay a new administrative fee. And so that $10,000 fee you would have had in the beginning, like I say, and then you'd you'd be paying at that point, if you want a second credit swap, a new administrative fee, which is substantial. We understand we're looking for feedback, but that's how seriously we're trying to take this. And if it doesn't work, we need to know why, and we need to know what the right dollar amount is. But you wouldn't have the $5,000 a month back end fee after that, like we were talking about. Right. So it'd be pretty significant. You're prepaying the administrative fee. And if the development is not, 50% complete, and this is where, again, this is a lot of information, but, we would consider the, development, receiving a new TDC limit, that's in effect as of January 1st of the year of that new credit swap request. So, recognizing if you haven't been able to, and that's if you have not been able to start construction, right? So there's something so egregious that has prevented you from moving forward, and you're not willing and to give the award back because you're after carryover allocation and you've paid your administrative fee originally and you're committed to that there's still a, you know, a path to completion, that that's how we would recognize it at that point. So that's a lot, right? And it's a lot of numbers that I just said. You don't have it in front of you, and I do. And so we're going to post this online. We wanted you to understand where we're coming from, why we were thinking of what we were thinking of. Kevin, is there anything you wanted to add on that or anything?
No, I think that in a summary, it might be easier to digest by looking at something, but yeah.
Yeah. So we will take, this is an appropriate time, obviously, to take comments and questions.
Steve Auger with Birdsong Housing. Really appreciate all the thought you're trying to put into getting deals that are more ready to go. On the developer experience, something that I just want to make sure that you're not forgetting the linkage. Great example, there's a Florida-based nonprofit that has been doing great work for years around special population. Now that we're in the RFA system, they put in applications this past year in a few different applications and got in a few different RFAs, got lucky in several of them. So all of a sudden, you know, now they have a lot to do. So if you're overwhelmed by capacity because you got lucky in a system which is geared towards randomness, where you've just got, you know, little predictability, and your shots at getting funded or, you know, or spread out throughout the year. If the developer experience is set up as a death penalty that's going to follow you forever, you know, that just doesn't seem fair.
Mm-hmm.
So if it was instead, you know, tied to you can't submit new applications if you haven't been able to. You know, if you got lucky enough to, you know, fight off a huge mouthful and you're struggling to chew it and swallow it, you know, that shouldn't tee you up for some kind of, you know, death penalty. You know, that should, you know, but you could tie it to not being able to submit new applications till you finish what you got.
Yeah.
You know, now if the system isn't so geared towards, you know, randomness, you know, then, and there's some more predictability, you know, and it's not, and it's the downside, you know, there's upsides, you know, to the current system, but one of the downsides is you just take lots of shots, and some years you get nothing, and some years you get a whole bunch. You know, so don't forget that linkage. You know?
Yeah, I don't think we weren't thinking of it like a death penalty. It was more a look back of a cycle, so that wouldn't follow you. It would have the net effect of what you're talking about. Like, you know, you couldn't get the points, but once you lived through that, it's kind of how we do developer applicant withdrawal disincentive now. Things fall off each year because and anything that's been an issue falls away. So it wouldn't be a...
Right. Just wanted to make sure it wasn't something that was going to stick with you.
Yes,
like that.
Definitely not. Yeah.
And personally, I don't even understand why you need a rule for a second credit swap. Those should be so rare that the rule is no second credit swap. And those should be so rare that, you know, that's what the rule waiver system is for. You know, the petitions for rule waiver are for when there are, you know, unusual, exceptional, you know, situations to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
And since the rule is you don't get a second one, then you can negotiate for another admin fee if you want to make that a part of it. But I don't even see why you need a rule for a second credit swap. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else in the room? Rodriguez coming up.
Good afternoon, Rodrigo Paredes, Housing Trust Group. Just wanted to say something about the penalty for, you know, extensions. In the developments I've done, I've never had problems with time frame except for developments with HUD. So, which is something that I, you know, something that at least I cannot control, and I think many people. So, I would say that if this goes forward, this intention to do this rule, to not apply this to developments that had to get HUD demolition approval or mixed finance approval. And as it relates to the credit swap, I am wondering if there's a way to, you know, have that possibility of being of getting into a credit swap be less, you know, less possible. So, you know, I've never requested a credit swap, but I do see some municipalities that take too long of a time to get your approvals so you can close. So I've seen how things are getting closer to the deadline of, you know, the second year after the credit years, but you have to place the service. So I am wondering if there's a way that the application cycles can be a little bit sooner, and if that would help on giving, you know, some municipalities the time frame that they take, so that when you complete construction, you're not right there next to the deadline of the placing service of 2 years after. I don't know if that's even possible. I don't know exactly what the rule is, but. And I guess that's all. I mean, that's it.
Thanks. All right. Thanks, Rodrigo. I think we've historically tried to pull the years, not the year, but the beginning of the cycle back. And every time we do that, some like natural disaster hits, or we just have something where we have to, and it's terrible, and you know, for other reasons. And so so we're mindful of that, but also we're always you know, looking at finding out what our appropriation is for sale, and that always impacts our big picture of what we're doing with the resources as well. But I appreciate that in terms of timing, and we're always trying to work towards not having those issues as well.
Hi, I'm Hannah Esper with Marais. I just want to echo on the HUD issue, because I do a lot of work with HUD financing, both assigning HAP contracts, doing Section ABB transfers of HAP contracts when you're trying to redevelop a very troubled property. If you have those kind of penalties in place for developers, I think it's going to really discourage folks from working on those much, much tougher projects. I'll also advocate for other federal funding like CDBG-DR. I'm working, as you all know, with some folks who got CDBG-DR money. It was awarded in September. The Part 58 still hasn't been approved yet, and our folks aren't willing to start really spending money until we know those funds are going to be released. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to have some exceptions when you're talking about doing this. I do think folks need to be held with timelines and that kind of stuff, but there are some funding sources and more challenging projects that I don't think you guys want to discourage people from taking on.
Thank you, Hannah. Seeing no one else approach the mic in the room, Leslie, could you tell us if there's anyone in the queue?
Yes, of course. There's no one there at the moment, but just as a quick reminder, it is just star, then one on your telephone. We do have a question now. It comes from Chris Bryant. You're live in the call, Chris. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Marissa, I just wanted to comment on the couple of issues here about, you know, potential future consequences on developer experience. And I know in the past when the corporation has wanted to attach point losses in scoring or similar impacts to actions taken by developers, they've published that in the RFAs and said, you know, be forewarned that from beginning with these RFAs, if you do certain things, they're going to impact your ability to score or points that can be awarded. And I think that approach is consistent with the concept of administrative due process, where, you know, parties are entitled to know what is permissible activity and what is not, so that if there's going to be negative consequences that are going to flow from requesting credit swaps, requesting extensions of time to get through credit underwriting, you know, they need to know that before they take those actions, if you're going to turn around then and potentially use that against that applicant, developer, or principal or financial beneficiary in the future. That's my comment.
Thank you, Chris.
Q, and we have no further questions.
We have another comment in the room.
Ken Naylor with Atlantic Pacific. It sounds like with some of the comments about HUD that there's sort of a recognition that you need to grade on a little bit of a curve. I think there's also the more units you're producing, the longer it'll take to create. And more units is better than fewer units. There's municipalities that where permitting is a lot slower than others, right? So possibly this is just something to think about. I'm not sure I'm sold on this idea. But if you approach time frames kind of the way you approach leveraging, and you said, hey, applicant, tell me how many days it's going to take to get you from allocation to financial closing, and you had a beeline, or you had quintiles, or you had octiles, or, you know, something crazy that Kevin comes up with, then you would have applicants saying, it's going to take me this long to get across the goal line, and then you'd have a baseline to penalize them on if they don't reach that by the date that they said they would reach it. So it's, you know, people would be able to recognize the complexity in their deal if they can accurately project how long it's going to take and perform, then they get full points next year. If they can't, then they have a problem.
Thanks, Ken.
Yep. I had a question. Is that like a 7-21-day item or is it an application item? What is that?
You just lost me. Sorry. Application has a scoring.
Right.
Application item where I say it's going to take me, you know, 380 days to get to closing, let's say. And then in the next application year, there's a points item of did I reach my previously promised time frame.
Okay, we're going to jump forward to the RFA-specific changes, and you will notice that it's almost 3 o'clock, but this is big stuff to talk about. So we're going to try to buzz through the RFA-specific requirements till we get to proximity. The large 6, and this is a continuation of the last workshop, there's really, we don't think any large changes here. We are coming through now the last year of the 2 counties being designated as geographic area of opportunity SATAs for the goals. And so this year it will be Hillsborough and Orange County having that as a goal. The remaining counties will be the LGAO and the contribution amounts we do not anticipate changing. And we will continue to pull up a second application in Broward County through binding commitment if necessary. So moving on. Miami-Dade County, so we've been talking about the goals for this RFA. We will still do a GAO, and we're going to talk about GAO more when we talk about future funding cycle and our analysis of GAO, but we're still going to do a family GAO goal, and we're still going to do an elderly development goal. And then we had talked about focusing a goal on urban centers and funding a development in an urban center. And we asked for feedback at the last workshop, should we tier that out, and those urban centers might mean something different depending on the tier that you're in terms of selection of funding. And also looking at feedback about where, you know, land availability is within those urban centers and things like that. And so what you have here is what we came up with, and Jean's going to pull up the, we have the urban centers on our mapping application so you can see where they are. And so they all, you know, Miami-Dade folks in the room already know them, and they're imprinted and you know everything. But for purposes of the discussion, we just wanted you to be able to have the visual In the agenda, it talks about the comp plan and what urban centers mean in regard to the comp plan. And so we designated the tier ones as those with existing rapid transit or plans for rapid transit and that have less than 10 developments currently funded through Florida Housing in our portfolio. So remember, we went back and said we didn't want to have a ton of a concentration of our portfolio, and we wanted to broaden that a bit. So those Tier 1 urban centers are listed there on the agenda, but we did look back in terms of demographics and what in our portfolio is currently at those urban centers. And so you'll notice for elderly, we have Naranja as an urban center if you've got an elderly development in that urban center. And then the remaining Tier 2 urban centers are set forth there below, and that's how we anticipate administering that. So we will take feedback about that. That's where we've landed on it from the continuation of the prior workshop. And one thing I wanted to mention, a comment that was made to me was whether there would be interest in Florida Housing focusing a goal, maybe not in this funding cycle, but in the future for a development that is a public-private partnership. And for some people, that will probably really make them perk up, and some people will think that's a terrible idea. But it's an interesting concept for us to consider coming off of CDBG-DR, where we focused on those relationships specifically with regard to getting affordability and perpetuity in some of those sites. And so we're not suggesting that we're going to do that in this particular funding cycle, but I thought it was worth mentioning as we look forward to different things that we're going to be doing and potentially in Miami-Dade, because we received a lot of applications in that RFA. So you'll note the last under Miami-Dade County 9% RFA, there's a priority 1-2 application discussion. We don't have anything different to say on that than what I said in the beginning of the workshop. We don't intend to move away from it. If you have suggestions about language that we can use to implement that to achieve what our intent is there, we're eager to accept it, listen to it, and try to implement that. And so we just put out a call for help on that. And then we'll move on to, we'll get through this part for the medium and small county geographic 9% RFA. So we are planning on doing that jointly. That is small, medium together in one RFA again. So this one's a little bit different, some concepts that we didn't talk about in the original workshop, but some of the same. So we still want to do a goal for 4 LGAO applications, but we have some discussion points there, one being contribution amount, and we have received feedback from certain local governments that even with pairing with county and city, or, you know, trying to within that county, everyone focus on one application, the contribution amount that we're at is problematic. And so we've been looking for feedback and thinking about, is there something where we do have a substantial contribution, do we go back to a method of tiered levels within the size of the county, you know, like the smaller medium county has a different contribution amount than the larger medium county. So we take feedback about that. We know it's challenging. And then do we need to add any other additional requirements to that? You know, we know the large counties have a very robust, for the most part, from we can tell, the local governments and thoughtful process for how they're designating their partner development. And we're still working with local governments on our end to educate, and it's not our job to administer their process for them, but we want to make sure that, you know, the intent of this is that a local government has something that they really want to see in their community, and this is a vehicle for them to find a partner to achieve that. And that's why it makes sense for us to be, you know, financing partners in that way. And, you know, some of the feedback we've been getting from local governments is, again, they're just getting their doors knocked on and things promised and what have you. And so so we're wondering if there's, you know, can we make certain types of requirements such as, you know, you have to have a number of meetings or that's sort of silly me saying that, but you get what I'm trying to get across is there's something more than just that dollar amount. Sort of in the vein of what we require for the revitalization goal that we're going to keep in this RFA as well. And what some could argue, well, you know, if they don't have the money, they can compete for the revitalization goal, because, you know, that's something there that's thoughtful, and which is true, but maybe revitalization is not what the goal is for that local government. So again, we'd be looking for feedback on that. And we're asking for feedback from local government partners as well. But anyway, four of those goals, two of the GAO status, which is just like this past year, a revitalization goal, and something we're putting out there is potentially a goal for a proximity to the SunRail. And we know that then will focus the conversation in another way because there's only certain medium counties that applies to. But what we've been thinking about is, you know, within a certain miles of a SunRail station, that we would be looking at in medium counties providing some type of incentive there. So that's really for discussion. This is not set in stone. We would want feedback about that. And then we are, you know, looking for feedback on one 100% nonprofit goal. We wouldn't do a nonprofit goal that would be our traditional definition of JV nonprofits. This would be in the vein of, you know, 100% of the developer fee going to a nonprofit and or nonprofits if you're, you know, partnering with another nonprofit entity. Again, speaking to our QAP, where we do want to go above and beyond with the nonprofit goal. And so this is for feedback, right? Again, and it's with an idea of saying we know that there's a lot of good work that's being done out there. It's hard to compete. And it's hard to know what to expect in terms of when you're coming in and applying. So big picture, we're always still trying to address that. And then this is probably the biggest change for this RFA that we're putting out there, is that remaining applications, you know, it has been just a pick-me-up after that, right? You know, we get through our funding goals, and then we just go ranking down the line of what money we have left and what highest-ranked applications there are. And we know that there have been, since we've implemented this LLGAO goal, there have been a number of medium counties applying, and we thought that it would be meaningful to pick up those LGAO applications that have come in previously and have that goal. And so we'll be looking for feedback on that end as well. So it would be a thoughtful remaining eligible application being those that are selected. And if there are none of those, we may get to that point that we're at now. But that's what we're looking for that. And then for preservation, just briefly, we would, you know, go through the funding test in that RFA and not stop. Right now, those of you who had the look back know that we stopped after with the elderly demographic, didn't continue to move down the line. We don't anticipate changing the percentage of our housing credits in the QAP that's designated to preservation, and so we just want to put a nod to that. And if the applications are coming in and you know, we've been implementing this DNA process, we would continue to on the front end do funding selection. Sales on here, but we're really not going to talk about it until we know what we're getting in terms of appropriation. So more conversation on sales to come, and hopefully it's really good and robust because we're going to get all that trust fund money. So with that, on the RFAs, I'll open up the floor for comments before we go to the phone lines.
Sean Wilson, Blue Sky Communities. On the large six, I would recommend that any developer that has won for five consecutive years in any county, they should not be eligible to receive the 9% allocation in that same county in the sixth year. I think last year, your GAO goal was only GAO, not SADDA?
It was not. It was SAD.
Okay, so
we changed it. We changed it last year, and so we would maintain that this year.
so that's a change. I think in the counties where there is the GAO but not in the LGAO, you should remove the match requirement.
Remove the match, meaning the
minimum local contribution.
The minimum local contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that if you're a GAO, you shouldn't have to then get approved by the county, the G or the city. I mean, the GAO is a higher income area. You're at risk of being NIMBY, and you're at risk of some shenanigans happening that prevent you from getting that local match. So you shouldn't make the developer go through that. I'm going to repeat a comment that I made before. I think there's an enormous need in Orange County, and all the large counties really, but it's especially acute in Orange County. And I think at some point that second deal should go to Orange and maybe rotate into some other counties as well. I think the priority 1-2 is good. I think it's great. I thought your language was tight last year. It looked to me like there was only one developer that divides themselves into several developers in order to circumvent that rule, and I think you should enforce it. I think that it is enforceable, the language you have now, but if you want to tighten up the language, that would be welcome. Blue Sky pledges to obey the spirit of the Priority 1-2 applications if you decide to implement it for the coming year. I think that the LGAO amount in medium counties and large is just, Kevin, you're not going to like this. It should be a flat amount. It's so confusing. I appreciate that you're not going to change it this year, but it should be so much easier if it was just a flat amount. And you answered some other questions, so thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, no one up?
Steve Auger. On the local government contribution amounts in median counties, I think part of it is deciding what your goal is, right? If your goal is fewer applications, you want it to be more exclusive. And if you keep it more exclusive and you're adding in other goals, which I think is good, if it's still a lottery-driven system, more goals, it is the way to go. Then you can use those goals to get to some of those other areas that are important for you to go to, if they are important for you to go to from a policy perspective, that are priced out by the local government contribution. If the goal of the local government contribution is to reduce, applications, and you just make it such a low level that anybody can play, it doesn't accomplish that. So just a thought there. If you're going with the P1, P2, I echo Sean's comments that what's really important is, to make sure that you're enforcing the rules, that you put out there. Part of the switch to the RFA process was, the significance of the corporation's interpretation of its rules in that, legal milieu, and I know that, that legal authority may change over time, but that, corporation's interpretation of its rules is still, as these cases have been playing out in this legal milieu, are still, a significant part of, of how those cases play out. When Florida Avenue had a proximity-driven system a few years ago, and you're talking about changes in that, you're talking about some significant changes if you go to a point system, which, I'm not against. I think there's some real thoughtful ways to do that. But in any situation where you're making significant changes, it's going to be hard to see everything coming. So if you say, this is what we're trying to accomplish, these are the rules, this is how we interpret the rules, and then someone's playing games with those rules, and you don't stand up and say, that's clearly not what we intended, that's clearly gamesmanship, and we're going to do something about that. Then it encourages folks to play games. So I think that don't draw lines in the sand if you're not ready to defend them. Um, and, and that's just, you know, something that I think that from an integrity of a process perspective, you know, is an important part of, you know, of that stuff. Thanks.
And I think we appreciate that, and those are two things we really pride ourselves on, being that we're transparent about what we're looking for, and we believe we do have integrity in the administration of the process. And part of that is involved with us workshopping, putting together an RFA, and doing what the terms of the RFA say, and we believe we do that, and we appreciate the feedback, and we don't back away from that. And when, you know, if there's a feeling that there's a better way for us to get there, like I said in the very beginning, we're always trying to get to that point. So I appreciate the comment. Rodrigo?
Rodrigo Ferreira, Housing Trust Group. Just a question on the second point after medium county calls for local government airport opportunities. So you were thinking on a preference for previously submitted applications. Can you expand a little bit more on that? It just didn't. Is it the intent for all the floors or goals to be for counties that were already already submitted? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that's confusing as I'm looking back at it again, because we say it up there and then we say it down below. You know, I think we'd be willing to take feedback either way. I think it's reasonable for us to say in the funding selection process, as we take the goals, that we wouldn't have to focus explicitly on ones that have already been submitted. And so a local government's been working towards it. They finally realize they've got their, you know, they've got the development they want to work with. They've been able to find the dollars for the contribution amount. I think from the front end, it would make sense for us to not have it be that tailored. But when we're pulling things up at the end, I think it's a way for us that we would pull that on the back end. So thanks for pointing that out, though. We would certainly need to make clarification on that.
Well, if that's a policy that ends up being put in place, I would say that not to look for all the four LTLs,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, there's some municipalities that are, you know, in the learning curve of understanding how great affordable housing can be for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it doesn't have to be for all the four of them. And actually, regarding the last pending money, you know, the last point, any remaining development selected, would be the LGAOs. You know, that's another thing that I would think that, you know, sometimes it's great for, you know, to leave it open for luck. Why? Because some of these municipalities don't really understand. Once they haven't had a development funded in the last 10 years, and the new elected officials don't understand how good this could be for the communities. Once they see a lottery-funded development that is great, that actually improves the value of that neighborhood, and everybody likes it, they start to making priority to affordable housing in a way that you didn't see in the past. So sometimes, you know, I came this day from visiting a site that, you know, I don't think that municipality has received funding in 10 years. They don't really get it, but once they see what we're going to build, they're going to be amazed. So.
Thanks for the feedback. And I think there's something for us to, as we narrow down, if we're tailoring proximity, we may not have to fully goal this out, right? So, I mean, I think Steve kind of mentioned that. It's like, well, if you have a lottery-based system, goals can be meaningful in a different way. So, so we appreciate that perspective. Another comment from the floor?
Keith Franklin, New Urban Development.
Hi, Keith.
How are you? I want to commend Florida Housing for having as one of its goals in the medium and small counties to fund a 100% nonprofit. I was curious to know if that same consideration was given for Miami-Dade County, and if not, just kind of hear some feedback.
We have not, and for no other reason, it has not come up until this point. And we've been turning from a predictability standpoint to the goals that we have put out there previously for Miami-Dade. We'd be willing to take feedback about it. And we have funded, though, nonprofit developments who meet those goals within, but
But we have not to this point.
I would definitely encourage it. As I'm sure you all are aware, there's a huge affordable housing need in Miami-Dade County. But I think there are a whole host of nonprofits who I think are capable of doing this work and wanting to do this work. And so any effort to kind of help with that, I think, would be beneficial.
Thanks, Keith. We're going to move forward, and there may be folks in the queue on the phone, and we appreciate you holding on because we want to jump into proximity. I think it's important to jump into those changes. And then as we open up for those final question and answers, if there's specific RFA questions that you all have on the phone lines, we'll address them then. And so I'm going to turn it over to Jean.
Thanks, Marissa. It starts off, and I'll try to be brief. We're changing a couple of definitions. Really, these are clarifications to medical facility and public school, and I think the language kind of speaks for itself here. And then there's also the public rapid transit bus stop. Some RFAs had changed this definition, and we're going to be making sure that all RFAs go back to the previous definition so they're all consistent in that. We're introducing two new community services. They haven't really been new. We used them a long time ago. We're going to bring them back from 2011, public park and public library. These are slightly different. A key change has to do with them being listed with and maintained by a local government department that manages, in the case of public park, manages parks for at least 5 years, and the public library, a library that's been part of a local government department that manages libraries for at least 5 years. And that's the key difference from what we did in 2011. If you've been with us a while, you'll see that. And the points that we're going to be using will be similar to what we use for public school. Public school points are awarded a little bit differently with a little larger different distances. And we're going to use that. But please note, this is an example of our quarter mile distances that we're going to be talking about in just a minute. You'll see that these are broken out by quarter miles. And you know, that's also something we did in 2011, but do pay attention to that. And then we go into transit. So what this means for transit, most deployment is what we've been doing. You'll still have the options of like one type of transit, using up to three public bus stops, one public bus transfer stop, one rapid transit stop, or one rail station stop on the same. And the points are awarded based on the distance between the development location point and that service. However, distances will be further divided into quarter-mile distances. We'll be carrying that forward through all of our different services. And elderly also will still have the option to use private transportation for their transit points. Community services. All applicants of family and elderly developments may select grocery store, medical facility, pharmacy, that's the same, public school, public park, and public library. All developments will be able to choose from all six of those. And there's no limit to how many. Points will be awarded based on the distance between the development location point and the service. However, distances are once again going to be further divided into quarter-mile distances and points accordingly. And all community services will be awarded up to 4 proximity points, with each application earning up to 24 points for community services and up to 6 proximity points for transit. So a total of 30 points is possible. And that minimum number of proximity points required for eligibility, we've had a threshold number of points that's required based on county size. That's not going to change for eligibility. The proximity funding preference will not change in the 6 counties' large geographic 9% housing credit RFA, or the preservation 9% housing credit RFA, or the sale family elderly RFA. But then, Marissa, do you want to talk about what else is changing?
Sure. So we have a proposal here to move to a proximity level system for Miami-Dade and small medium, again, where we get the most amount of applications. And this system, ideally, you think of it the way you think of the leveraging for sale with the leveraging levels. So it would replace the proximity funding preference as the tiebreaker, and they would be listed in ascending order, beginning with the applications with the highest number of proximity points and ending with the applications with the lowest number of proximity points. And you would be assigned your level based on the pot of other applications, right? So it's sort of that balance between proximity funding preference, you're getting it. You know, if you don't get it, you're not getting it. The hard point, you know, specific number that may or may not be able to be achieved, we thought this may be blended both of those in a different way. Would take feedback about it. Obviously, we've never done this before, so I'm sure everybody's got a reason to say why it's, you know, wouldn't work. But that was the thought process behind it. So you're getting a level of predictability, but it's based on the other universe of applications that are coming in. And so the so you would get those assigned levels. And then we have the tiebreakers. We have some additional proximity tiebreakers that would be used in the, as it says there, the preservation and sale and the GORFAs. And they're set forth there. And the tiebreakers would be used after either the proximity level tiebreaker that we talked about for Miami-Dade and small medium, or the proximity funding preference. So again, this is sort of getting further at what are you close to within the universe of those things. So we look to the preference for applications that are within 2 miles of a grocery store. They would be preferred over applications that are not. Applications, actual proximity points for the two highest community services, and proximity to transit services for the large RFAs where transit is something that's required. So those are some of the ideas we had. And you may say, well, all that means is then you're just going to get applications that all of them have grocery stores that are within 2 miles, and maybe that's what happens. Or maybe it's not. But we would take feedback about that. Again, just trying to hone in there on what the right thing would be. And we also acknowledge that if we implement the levels, that would mean something. We'd have to phrase it differently for applications that in the current system now we say just automatically qualify for the preference. Like LGAO automatically gets the proximity funding preference because the local government is supporting it, so we trust that. So what we would be thinking about is ways for those in the large six, you'd still automatically get your qualification because we'd still be having proximity funding preference. But in the other RFAs, essentially removing that aspect from the selection of the goals in some way. So we know we have to address that. We don't want folks thinking, well, now we're all still just going to have to do all this proximity, even though the whole point of LGAO is to maybe not have to do that. We'll be thinking about that. So those are some of the considerations that we are that we're thinking about for proximity for those changes. And I'm sure there's folks that have comments in the room, so I want to jump right to that. The mic is open. Anybody?
Steve Auger. This is always the fun part to me, so I like this part. I don't know why they're being so quiet. What I like about this is if it's a concrete idea about a delineator, that if we don't think that's really what ought to be delineating deals, it forces us to try to come up with something better for you. And I'm not, you know, I think there's instances where that shouldn't necessarily, as the problem with the lottery is, okay, if we're get into trying to come up with ways to delineate deals that aren't really meaningful delineators over this one better than that one, then let's just have a good threshold and then kick it to randomness, right? And then you're always managing that. So I appreciate the thought of, all right, let's try to get serious about delineating what's a better deal than another deal. So just this in and of itself, I don't know that it hits that threshold, but as a piece of something, I think it's a really interesting idea. And again, you putting out ideas that, hey, this is what we're thinking. And I think you've come up with some really thoughtful ways to solve some of the problems that arose back in the 2011 cycle when we had proximity as a delineator and had some problems with how we defined stuff. It looks like you guys have been thoughtful about solving those. So I thank you.
Thank you. You should move to our front seats.
So, Rodrigo Paredes, Health and Trust Group. I just want to talk about the library, the public library. You know, back then I support public libraries, but nowadays I feel like public libraries are not getting bills. So the limit of the amount of public libraries that are now open is incredibly low. Nowadays with the Amazons and the Internet and the Audibles and the Kindles of the world, they're getting used less. So I'm not sure if that's a good policy-driven community service to score. I think it's going to complicate or put some areas in competition. You know, so, you know, being the top score to be 24, so there's 6 items with public library, so people are going to tend to all try and get the items that are next to a public library. So I'm not sure that's something that Board of Housing wants to do, so I would encourage you guys not to include public libraries. Public parks, yes, there's everywhere, and, you know, that's fine, and that's it for now.
Thanks, Rodrigo. I think one of the things, just to, and everyone can still line up here, we talked about that because there is, you know, depending on who you ask, a feeling that public libraries could be somewhat antiquated. But what we also know is they're trying to keep up and provide programming, community programming. I think there's value in public libraries beyond the books on the shelf, frankly. And so you'll notice we didn't try to pick on community services or, you know, the senior centers again and bringing those type of things in. But we thought in some ways now public libraries serve more community needs. And so that was the thought process behind it. And now, yes.
Hannah Strom, right? Yeah, I'm going to agree with you on the libraries. The libraries are places where rolling folks have access to computers, they have access to services, they can take their kids and get books when they can't afford a Kindle and download books on them. So I do think the libraries serve an important place in our community, and we should value those.
Thank you.
Hey, good afternoon. Chris Shearer, McDowell Housing Partners. I think the proximity preference and the scoring based around proximity is a overall good delineator. A couple of quick things that I noticed in here. The 1 acre park requirement, I think urban areas, a lot of smaller parks in the large counties, so that's something I would consider looking into. I think previously the definition had a requirement that the park be listed on a county or city website. Just wondering what the change was to go to a definition where it's now managed by a local government department from just being a listed, you know.
I think the senior center was something that had to be listed, but I don't think our public park definition was that it was, sorry.
I thought they took the exact definition, but I'll look at that.
Oh, this is the same one that was before. That's my fault. And it's going back to LGAOs. So the idea, if I heard it, was that LGAOs will not get full proximity points as they had in the past. So that way they are still competing. Otherwise, you'd have 4 goals in here for an LGAO and then previous preferences for the remaining funding to go to LGAOs that were previously submitted. So if that takes out the proximity funding or proximity preference, then basically LGAOs are going to win out. And proximity preferences will have less weight.
And we recognize that there's an issue with that for where we land, and if we land with this more robust proximity, maybe we don't totally goal out LGAO. I'm willing for feedback. Yep.
Great. In LGAOs, I find there's a lot of it's evolved since the initial implementation. It's been a few years now. It seemed like it was a lot of local governments who had something that they've been working on, that they've been targeting, and they wanted to bring it and get it funded, and we wanted to give them some preference. But it seems like it's evolved or devolved in the sense now where it's a lot more of a lobbyist-driven application process. There's a lot of time that's involved there. There's certain developers who have repeatedly won due to those relationships in those communities, and not always the best development I see getting funded. If you're sticking with that, and the LGAOs are around to stay, and, you know, consider opening it up so that elderly and a family deal can be supported by local government. Inevitably, only one development will be funded. There's never enough typically go around to the counties or again. So it would open it up for other applicants. It would open it up because there's usually a need on both sides. And most of the time, family deals are being presented under the LGAO contribution. And then, going off base here, since I'm up here, this is not on the agenda. I did submit a public comment on the QAP. However, it does relate to RFAs. Something that I see in other states, I think is a very good public policy initiative, that, and it's in the QAP as one of the priorities to serve the lowest income tenants and lowest income residents, I'd like the corporation to consider including an ELI basis boost. So right now the GAO basis boost works very well. It drives development and provides some incentive to work in certain locations. But this would, I think, provide that incentive and provide the social benefit of serving lowest incomes. It would get you the 30% basis boost, where otherwise you're not a QCP or DBA. You can't secure the boost, which may come into play and help you. But what it really does is it allows you to get the increased maximum housing credit request. And that would be a big incentive to offset the cost of building an ELI unit and operating the ELI unit, which don't generally make sense. So most people are doing the minimum 10 to 15%, whether they're doing income averaging or trailer set aside. Nobody's really going beyond that. There's no incentive to do so. So if delivering ELI units is something of importance, I think that's a good method to drive some additional development of those units. I leave that open, you know, intentionally in my comment. I didn't prescribe it. Admittedly, I haven't done a lot of math around it to kind of see what the offset would be. But overall, I think it's something I just wanted to bring to the floor for consideration and, you know, stakeholders to try to comment on.
Thanks, Chris.
Sean Wilson, Blue Sky Communities. Definitely agree with what Steve Auger said. Disagree with what Rodrigo said. I think libraries are important. At the risk of contradicting myself, I would caution you against reducing the LGAO amount in Median County, because I think that gets to a broader point that needs to come out, which is consistency with what I'm hearing from the lawmakers, which is, what are local governments doing? What are local governments doing? So local governments can put in money. We don't want to now say, well, now they can put in less money, because I think that maybe goes against what is happening in the Capitol. I do think that additional delineators should be granted, again, in response to what, again, I'm hearing it. I don't know if other people are hearing it from lawmakers. You know, what are cities and counties doing? Well, they can give parking reductions. They can give setback waivers. They can do other regulatory things. So developments that have gotten regulatory, really gotten them, not just in cities and counties where they're available, but cities and counties that have given a regulatory incentive to an applicant, that should also be a delineator. And in response to, I'm going to leave it right there because I don't know how to.
Thank you. Okay.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for the tag. I do agree with the library. I like libraries. I take my grandson there all the time. The ELI basis boost that Chris was talking about, I do agree with that because it works for public housing developments, it works for Section 8 developments, it works for preservation. So I think if you went down that road, I think you would kind of be covered for a lot of the asks that I would be making. But if you don't want to do that, then I would ask that you give public housing the 30% boost, and you keep the 30% boost in the proximity, or not the preservation that you have. As far as the LGAO goes, I do believe that smaller cities in some of the counties that don't get the money, that have a lot of input from the city and the county and a lot of support, but they just don't have the funding because they don't get home or they get a very, very small amount of shifts, I think they should be offered the same opportunities to try and build.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
Sean Wilson, Blue Sky Community. Walk score, and this is the definition of insanity, I know, but walk score is also a potential delineator. I think it's not manipulable, and it's a real website that demonstrates how walkable sites are. And in response to a point that Chris Shear just made, with regard to if you're going to do quintiles now for proximity, then maybe a prior LGAO that's coming in for a second time should automatically be quintile one. I think that, I don't know what Chris is, but that would get rid of a situation where somebody got an LGAO on a maybe it doesn't have the greatest proximity, but then that's held against them in a future cycle.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Before we open up the phone lines, in the effort of continuing, we have two big things that I want to make sure we address before we just call out and continue with any public comments. And that's, you know, the next section is talking about looking forward to the next funding cycle. So we're going to be very brief on this. As it says here, we'll continue to look at the GAO methodology, but it's staying the same for this funding cycle. I wanted to turn it over to Laura because we have an item on here, preservation of properties in the corporation's portfolio. And so for those of you who have been following the preservation plan, we wanted to speak to that. So, Laura?
Thank you. So at our December 2018 board meeting, our board approved a preservation action plan for recapitalizing aging properties in our own portfolio. And we look at it as a roadmap and that gave strategies to implement for the future. Strategies 1 to 3 were for immediate, and the others were future, which is now. So on the last two pages of that plan that Jean actually posted on the website for this RFA, is a conceptual matrix for prioritizing what properties we should preserve. And we're looking for feedback, so if you could submit comments on what the general criteria for all properties, the property risk factors, and then whatever priority levels you think there should be. We've got some laid out, obviously, but we'd really appreciate your feedback on that. You can send them to me, it's laura.cox@floridahousing.org, or Bill Aldinger, our policy director. He's bill.aldinger@floridahousing.org. And that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura. We're going to go to the phone lines to take a few that are in the queue, and then we are going to go and have our on-the-agenda Procorum software update by Dietra Arnold. So we're going to do some phone comments if we have anybody in the queue now who's been waiting, and then make sure we get that presentation in because we're really excited to roll that out to you all. So, Leslie, could you let us know if there's anybody in the queue?
We have nobody waiting at the moment, but just as a quick reminder, it is just star then one on your telephone.
Well, in the meantime, while folks are figuring that out, we're going to turn it over to Dietra. So just a note on this. Some of you do know and have been a part of sort of the soft rollout of our Procorum system. Florida Housing has a new software system for multifamily that we call ProLink, and Procorum is the external facing component of this. And essentially, it's helping us to get to a really great communication portal that is secure and helping us be paperless and, like, really in the current times. And Dietra joined us in multifamily specifically this year. She's our business process analyst who is specifically working with the ProLink and the Procorum system. And so we're so pleased to have her. She is Florida Housing employee, she's going to walk you through what this looks like. And what this means to you in terms of RFAs is that when you sign your applicant certification and acknowledgement form, you are agreeing that you are going to use the Procorum system with us. So everybody's, again, coming into this together, and hopefully you'll be able to talk to your peers who have already been interfacing with this, and our credit underwriters have been interfacing with this, and we're continuing to learn more about it as we go through it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dietra.
Okay, thank you, Marissa. I'll be brief. There are recordings of this presentation on our website, and I'm doing a voiceover, so I go in a lot more detail online, so I really advise you to go out there and look at that. I just want to do a brief overview. I don't want to make my first impression where I caused you guys to go over on time, so I'll make this brief. Marissa gave a really good overview of this system, Procorum. It is external and internal facing, so we will invite you all to join in the system in order for us to collaborate with you. So what I'm going over today will give you a brief understanding of how the system works, how you can set up your account once you're invited to use the system, and then the ability to upload documents. So again, what is Procorum? Marissa gave you a really clear definition of that, so I'll skip over that. But there is a hierarchy to this system. We have you who will be the user, as well as our internal staff who will also be considered a user. We have work centers. That will be a term that you'll hear often when we're talking about Procorum. So you will be invited into a work center to do the collaboration. And then within that work center, there's a structure of folders. And within those folders, there are files. So this slide gives you some detail about the hierarchy of Procorum. And then within the work center, you have the ability to create posts, kind of like our social media nowadays, Facebook. You can post things, and everyone that's your friend can see those posts. So within ProQuorum, everyone who is invited into that work center and they are considered a collaborator can see everything that you're posting there. You can have the ability to have a task assigned to you. So an example would be during the invitation to credit underwriting, we would invite you into credit underwriting. And so we may assign you a task to respond to that by accepting the invitation. So we would assign you that task. That task will have a deadline, and then you will be sent a reminder that you need to complete that task. Any tasks that are assigned to you will be published to a calendar that is also in the ProQuorum Work Center, so you can see any outstanding tasks that you have, any tasks that you have completed, or any future tasks you would be able to view on that calendar. And then within ProQuorum, I'll show you shortly where there's an activity feed. So on social media, you have a news feed. Within ProQuorum, you have an activity feed. So if you are invited into a work center, any activity that has taken place within that work center either prior to you joining or while you are involved in the work center will show up on that activity feed. So in order to get started, if it's your first time, you'll probably receive two emails. Your first email will be an invitation to join ProQuorum. You have to follow the instructions that are provided in that email in order for you to get started. So you'll receive an invitation email with wording of who actually invited you into the work center, and then you're provided with a link. You want to click on that sign-up link within your email. You are immediately brought to a screen that will pre-populate your first name and last name, as well as your email address, and then it provides you with the credentials that you would use in order to set up your password. At the very bottom, it's very hard to see on this screen as well as on your computer screen, there is a little checkbox, and next to that checkbox is blue font of the terms and conditions that you can actually click on and read if you want. If not, just simply check that box, and then right above that is the orange box where you would sign up. Once you sign up, you want to navigate back to your email address or your email account so that you can confirm the email that you have now signed up for ProQuorum. Once you have confirmed this email, you are immediately brought to your home page. Very simple, very intuitive. It gives you the activity feed of any work center that you are invited to. You can be invited to several work centers. Within that invitation, in each work center that you're invited to, you will receive an email. But once you've set up your account that very first time, you no longer have to click on those emails that are inviting you to those work centers. You have the ability to access all work centers from this screen once you've logged in that one time. So you would log in, you see your activity feed. On the left-hand side is where your work centers will be listed. If you're joining for the first time, you may not see all of your work centers. You may want to go into your email just to be sure that you were truly invited to work centers. Within the ProQuorum system, it's actually linked to our Outlook account internally as well as your email account externally. So anytime there's activity that takes place within ProQuorum, you're going to receive emails. So if you're not someone that's in that will not be in ProQuorum every single day, you will definitely get notifications that activity is taking place within ProQuorum via email. So right now, I want to walk you through your preferences. This is the first thing you probably want to start looking at once you get invited into a work center so that you can customize your notifications in the beginning. So on the far right-hand side of the screen, you'll see your name. You have the ability to click there. And there's a drop-down that will appear, and you want to click on the preferences option. Once you click there, you're brought to a screen that presents you with a ribbon across the top where there's several options. The first option is your profile page. On this page, you can actually add as much or as little information as you want about yourself or your company, because once you're in a work center, everyone else that are considered collaborators within that work center can see this information about you. So you have the option to add as much or as little as you like. The next tab is the picture option. It's really nice to see you in the work center, so to have a picture added there would be great. So yeah, it's very simple. If there's no picture there, you just click on upload picture. It brings up the folder on your computer. If you have a picture saved there, you can select that picture. It crops it automatically for you, and then you just save the photo, and it pops in. The next tab is invite. So this is another place where in order for you to see what work centers you've been invited to, you can actually check here. Instead of going out to your email, if you get hundreds of emails a day, you don't want to funnel through all of those emails. You can actually click on invite, And this will show you any invites that you've accepted to work centers, any invites that are pending, or any invitations that you have actually sent, which will be limited because we will give you permission to invite collaborators. To start off with, I think we're going to invite everyone that you want to be invited into the work center. You also have the ability to change your password. So if you originally set up a password that you're not satisfied with and you know that you're not going to remember, once you've logged in, you can actually navigate to this screen and it will allow you to enter your current password and then change it to one that works better for you. So this is very important, the preference tab. This is for those who are in the room that have already joined our ProQuorum Work Centers. You are probably very familiar with a lot of the email notifications that you're getting. So today we will show you how you can actually control that on your end. On this preference tab here, this email configuration actually controls all of ProQuorum. But we'll go into a little bit more detail on how you can actually control your email notifications down to each individual work center. You may be invited to 30 work centers, but you're only interested in 5 of those work centers out of the 30. So we can go in to actually limit not receiving any emails at all for the remaining 25 work centers. So to control your email notifications overall for ProQuorum, on this preference page, you only have 2 options. You have an option to receive emails or to not receive emails at all. So if you want to be someone that that does not want to receive emails at all, you just come in on a regular to check your ProQuorum account, you can actually elect to choose this option here. But I definitely recommend going in at the work center level to control those emails, and we'll walk through that shortly. You will also receive an email notification once a day, and it's called our Daily Digest. And what that Daily Digest consists of is a rundown of all of your work centers. So it gives you a brief summary of the activity that has taken place in all of your work centers. You can actually opt to receive that Daily Digest email on a daily basis or on a weekly basis. And if you want to change that option, you have the ability to do that here. But once you sign up for ProQuorum, it's going to automatically default to the daily option. Once you select your changes here, you want to be sure to save those changes, so if not, you're going to continue to receive those emails if you opted not to. So once you are in an actual work center, this is pretty much what it is going to look like. It's going to give you a set of folder structures. So you'll have folders, and then within that folder or folders is where you're going to see the actual files. On the very right-hand side of that screen is where you would actually locate your name. You would click on your name. You only have the ability to click on your name. And then under your name is where you're presented with 2 options. There's 2 checkboxes there. And beside each checkbox, one is labeled immediate email with a question mark. And then there is one that's titled include and digest. And so if you want to limit the emails that come in, so anytime someone goes in and downloads a file, uploads a file, add a comment, create a post, you're going to get an email about that. So if you want to limit that email, we call those our immediate emails. You can actually navigate to that particular work center, which will more than likely be named the development that you're working on. You want to navigate to that work center, find your name on the right-hand side, and then you want to uncheck that immediate email box. I would recommend keeping the digest box checked because you would at least see that one email at the end of the day that gives you an overview of all of your work centers and the activity that has taken place in it. So this next screen just gives you detailed information on what the immediate emails stand for and then what the daily digest, and it's a screenshot of what that daily digest looks like. So when you access this document on the website, I'll give you a lot of information on what each one represents. Uploading files, pretty simple. As I talked about earlier, on the left-hand side, you're going to see the work centers that you are a part of. So you can always access that work center by clicking on the left-hand navigation. Once you click on that work center, it brings you to the file and folder structure. You want to select what folder you're uploading to. So right now, we have a naming convention where it's going to have like application, credit underwriting, or multifamily, and then within that multifamily folder, you'll have your credit underwriting, depending on what funding is associated with that particular development. So you want to click on that folder. It'll then take you to the next area where you have the ability to upload files. And so at the very top, it's green, and I put a red box around it so it kind of stands out to you. You can click on that button, It brings you to a screen where you can either drag your file over or do it the kind of old, well, not old fashioned, I don't want to say that, but do it the more, I guess the way that everyone knows how to do it, traditional way. You would select the file from the folder on your computer, and then you would upload it that way. When you are selecting the folder, it is best practice to put in a description of what that file is. I know you would already have it titled something, but it's good to let us know a description, and then if you have any comments you would like to add about that document, you can do so here as well. So the thing that I love about ProQuorum is that if there is a document that already exists and you've made some changes, you have the ability to upload different versions to that particular document. So if you've uploaded one and there were some changes to that document and you want to now upload the new document, the old version will remain there. But then once you upload, you really don't have to do anything on your end except for follow the simple steps of uploading. The system will actually title it version 2 for you or version 3, version 4. So anytime you're uploading a new version of a document, the system will know that and it'll automatically give it that new version name. As I mentioned earlier, you have the ability to create posts. So if you're someone that has elected to not receive immediate emails anytime someone goes in and create a post, you will not get an email of that post. You can navigate to ProQuorum and see that post in your activity feed. But if you're someone that does not mind getting all of the emails, anytime someone goes in and posts into the ProQuorum Work Center that you are a collaborator on, you will get that post in a email. So that post will come to your email inbox as a normal email, and you can see exactly what was posted in ProQuorum. I go here in detail about tasks. I have about 5 minutes, Marissa, so I don't know. Keep going.
No, yeah, we're fed up. Yeah,
okay.
Well, yeah.
So, yeah, the task here, I kind of talked about it earlier. You can go onto the website. I give you a lot more detail about what the task entails, who has the permissions to complete and finish a task. One of the things that I've been seeing a lot in the work centers is that for those of you who are currently using ProQuorum, you may go in and finish a task and you mark it as finished, but you're getting an email that is overdue. That's because we have to mark it as completed on our end, and once we do that, you should no longer receive that email. But it's okay if you're getting the overdue email. We do have the date and time stamp of when you actually completed the task.
Awesome, Deetra.
That's it. If you have any questions, you can reach out to me, deetra.arnold@floridahousing.com.
So this
.org,
is,
sorry.
Yes. So this, Deetra's PowerPoint is on the competitive page and the non-competitive page as well, and this RFA workshop page, so you can send it to your staff and have them go through it, and Deetra walks through it in detail. So we only have a few minutes left, and our audit committee needs to meet. I wanted to open up the lines for any comments or questions before we conclude, truly. So, operator, could you let us know if there's anyone on the line?
Yeah, we do have one question. It comes from Dee Brightwell. You're live in the call, Dee. Please go ahead.
I was just going to make one comment regarding the public library. I was trying to click in before the whole Proxium thing. I would make a suggestion just because certain areas and with funding, there's been, you know, lots of libraries that either close or reduce services. I was going to maybe make the suggestion that if the intent is to have some of that type of service or ability for, you know, local services through organization, that maybe that's an or kind of thing, that either public library or senior citizen center that would provide similar type services, or maybe a community center that provides some of those types of educational or services to get onto computers, et cetera, that I think you're trying to get the library to be. I just know in like more small counties that it can be detrimental or very difficult to have libraries and be close to those. So it's just a suggestion.
Thank you for the feedback. And could you identify who you're affiliated with? What organization?
Arbor Valley Development.
Thanks, Dee. Any other comments in the room before we wrap up or questions? Okay, well, thanks everyone for your feedback. Like I said, we'll be scheduling another workshop, and we'll see you hopefully tomorrow at the board meeting. Operator, that'll conclude the call.
Thank you, Sarissa. Thank you, everyone. That concludes your conference call for today. You may now disconnect. Thank you for joining me.
Good to see you.